It's Central Time. I'm Rob Parrish. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, two workers' rights advocates talk about the state of child labor laws in the U.S. after the deaths of two 16-year-olds in factories, one here in Wisconsin. First, new data from Yelp, OpenTable, and the U.S. Department of Commerce show that Americans are dining out more now than in previous years, to the point that they're spending more at restaurants than at grocery stores. But even though restaurants have been experiencing more traffic, there are concerns in the industry over costs of food, labor, and credit card payments. We're checking out the state of the restaurant business here in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How often do you go out to eat? Have your habits changed over the last few years? What kind of dining do you enjoy? Fast food, fine dining, something in between? How about takeout? Where does that fit into your meal decisions? Join in at 800-642-1234. And if you work in restaurants or own a restaurant, love to hear your perspective on changes you've seen in recent years. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Susan Quam is the Executive Vice President of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, these national reports I'm looking at, Susan, suggest that, yeah, people have gone back to restaurants since the low point of COVID. Numbers of at least customers looking pretty good to compared to pre-COVID times. What are you hearing from restaurants here in Wisconsin?
Well, we're definitely hearing that the demand is there. We know that people are willing to travel again and get out, and our tourism industry is definitely on the mend from, you know, pandemic-related issues. And restaurants play a huge, you know, role in tourism here in the state. And even folks are saying their local traffic is up and is doing well. It looks like in our world, you know, consumer spending is up about 8% in the last 12 months in restaurants, where, you know, non-restaurant type of spending is just up less than a percent. So we know people want to go out, and we know people are out there. But part of the concern is whether or not they can, you know, that our operators can meet that demand.
I'll say personally, I definitely got more in the habit of doing things like delivery or takeout during COVID. Am I normal? Is that something that a lot of restaurants are seeing, more continued demand for the takeout services than, say, pre-2020?
They definitely are. You know, utilizing carryout or doing even having delivery either by a third party company or by the restaurant employees themselves was definitely on the rise pre-COVID. And then we saw, obviously, that was some of the lifeline that a lot of restaurants had to keep themselves open. That while it has gone down compared to COVID times, we definitely are still seeing a much higher use of delivery and carryout than what we were seeing in 2019.
Now, more customers sounds like pretty good news. There are some other factors out there. We've seen concerns over the last few years about labor, the costs of labor. Can restaurants find enough people to keep up with that demand? What are you seeing out there?
Well, we're seeing that, you know, in the last 18 months, average restaurant has increased their wages to their employees by over 25%. That's pretty significant compared to the national average of wage increases that you've seen around the country. And even with the increase in wages and additional and the great flexibility and part-time opportunities that the restaurants have and offer many of their employees, especially those who are, as we call them, front of the house, you know, the folks that you see that are serving customers, we're still over 12,000 employees behind what we were in prior to the pandemic. You know, so we're down 6%. The restaurant industry in Wisconsin prior to the pandemic employed 9% of the working population. We now employ 8%. That 12,000 people is a pretty significant number of openings that we have.
And so we all may have noticed the price of food, especially in the midst of higher inflation, going up. I'm guessing restaurants aren't exempt from those forces.
They are not. In fact, they're hit even harder than the general consumer is seeing in the grocery store. You know, we have some products that are running like at 100% or even higher than what they were just 18 months ago, especially things like deep fry oil and other fats and greases that are used in the industry. And in a state that depends on things like the Friday night fish fry, that's a pretty hefty expense in increase on a large volume product. And there's quite a few other commodity products that are, you know, involved in bakery goods, a lot of our center of the plate items like beef and other items, you know, they've definitely seen, especially in the restaurant side of it, a much higher increase inflationary than you see in the grocery store.
Talking to Susan Quam, Executive Vice President of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, talking about the latest news from the restaurant business. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you dine out more than you used to once upon a time, say 3 years ago? Do you get carryout more often? Do you work in restaurants or run a restaurant yourself? What are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Susan, with these costs, both of labor and lack of labor in some cases, and those higher food costs, what kind of changes have you seen restaurant owners make to adapt?
Sure. On the food side of things, what we're seeing is a lot of operators are just streamlining their menus, or they may be trading out certain things in their menus for other things as substitutions, both in order to get the products that might be available, or to, you know, take advantage of something that might be have a little bit lower price point that they can incorporate, which in turn also helps them not have to raise their menu prices as high as they should be doing in order to make up those costs. So that's definitely something that we are seeing out in the operations. And you might see even at your favorite supper club, the menu is going to change, or the types of entrees that they're offering might change in order to meet the demands of that particular customer base. On the labor side of things, I mentioned before the wages are increase on an average of about 25% just in the last 18 months. But there's a lot of things that like we're doing with our members and the folks that we touch up here at the Restaurant Association is helping operators also understand the other types of things they need to be the employer of choice. So they do a great job of retention of the employees that they have. So that's definitely something that we're seeing. But in as well as that, we're also seeing restaurants aren't going to be open as many hours as they used to be, or in many cases, as many days as they used to be, because they want to make sure that they give the employees that are there for them time off so that they can have days to do their errands and get some days of rest and have some time off, just like every other person in the marketplace. So a lot of restaurants that used to be open 7 days a week, they're now open 5 days a week or even less than that. And then it's not just Mondays and Tuesdays they take off. Sometimes we're seeing restaurants are taking off, you know, are closing on a Sunday or a Thursday, which are normally higher traffic days, but they want to make sure that they have a rested staff for the other busy times that they have during the week.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Gabriel is with us in Platteville. Gabriel, hi.
Hi, Gabe. I'm you and not Gabriel. Anyway, I just wanted to let you know I'm a first-time caller, first-time listener. I live in Texas. I'm just happen to be driving through Wisconsin and happy to be here. So I was just wanting to make a comment that unfortunately for the last 2 to 3 years, my family is not as financially stable as we once were. And we're still working on it, and we're working on you know, making progress. However, I have found it a trend for me over the past 2 or 3 years to download apps for fast food restaurants. And it's something that I've been doing that in search of a way to save money. And, of course, there's always the convenience factor. However, it is unfortunate because I find that the more that I use that stuff, the more I rely on it. And obviously it's not the healthiest of options. And it's not very encouraging. But that is the comment that I wanted to make. And thanks for taking my call.
Gabriel, thanks for the call and welcome. Enjoy your time here in Wisconsin. Susan, Gabriel grappling with, you know, he finds himself eating fast food more often, he says, not sure about the health side of things. I don't know, what an insight into one consumer's thinking on restaurants there.
Well, I can definitely empathize with Gabriel's, what he's looking for is every consumer out there is concerned about the prices that they're seeing. And definitely our restaurant operators are hearing that too, about menu price increases. One thing that a lot of operators are doing, especially in the quick service or fast casual marketplace, is they are instituting loyalty programs. And a lot of the apps that, you know, Gabriel was referring to, you know, definitely have have opportunities for the app users to get earn free items, maybe get a free, you know, something free for that day, or they earn money off, or and they encourage repeat usage of that. And what those folks are doing is trying to drive repeat business, which, you know, helps increase the volume that they're doing. And with the average restaurant making only 3-5% profit margin pre-tax, you know, driving, while they may be lowering their profit margin by doing what they're doing, they're driving up the volume of business and making up for it. So that's definitely an area. But I know that a lot of other restaurant operators that aren't in that space are definitely looking at other types of loyalty programs or ways to reward customers that are repeat users at their restaurant, and allows in doing so also, you know, keeps their base business going. As far as the nutrition side, I would have to say, you know, there are some great choices at all of our restaurants out there for those folks who are looking for specific nutritional types of food or the certain things that they're looking for. So those options are there, Gabriel. Just hopefully you can take advantage of them maybe the next time you're using your app.
Thanks for the call, Gabriel. We're talking to Susan Quam, Executive Vice President of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, looking at recent consumer trends in dining and how Wisconsin restaurants are doing in the current economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you go out to eat a lot, or do you get takeout from restaurants a lot? How has it changed for you over the last few years? What are you seeing? Are you seeing differences when you go to your favorite restaurant? Different hours, a different staff all the time, the menu changed? If you work in the restaurant business, love to hear about your experiences. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Susan Quam, Executive Vice President of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. We're talking about trends in dining, the latest on the restaurant business, and how they've recovered from the early days of the pandemic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you own a restaurant, how has inflation, especially with food costs, maybe labor costs, affected your business? What are you doing to keep up with what your customers want? If you go to restaurants, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in southern Wisconsin. Rick, hi.
Hi. I got a question for you. How are the restaurants in the area supposed to keep up with the food trailer business during the pandemic? A lot of the quality employees went out and did their own thing, and now we're forced to try to do things with the younger generation without training, and you end up going to product instead of Housemates products because they don't have.
Rick, I think we lost our connection there, but Susan, Rick seeing problems, competition from food trucks, losing that experienced labor in some cases, and the difficulty of training new people.
Well, he's definitely experiencing a lot of some of the issues that restaurant operators around the state are looking at. And I think one of the biggest issues we're seeing, and this happened during the pandemic, is that a lot of folks who had part-time jobs or maybe a full-time job in the restaurant and hospitality industry when the pandemic hit and the prolonged shutdown in certain areas, a lot of those folks went and found jobs somewhere else in totally different industries, and they have not come back to the restaurant and hospitality side. So that is a definite reason why we're short on those 12,000 employees that I mentioned earlier. The thing that we're encouraging operators to do, especially when it comes to recruiting and keeping your employees, and especially working with the younger generation, say the Gen Z, is really starting to learn what is most important to those employees and why and what they are looking for as they are becoming employed, and learning, you know, to work with the different generations. Because what we have been finding and learning is that, you know, each generation learns differently. Each generation has different reasons for why they work and what they're looking for in their employment. And so we want to encourage our operators to be that employer of choice, and definitely tailor their training and what they do to help engage their employees in that respect. As far as food truck goes, you know, the food truck industry is booming. We see it as definitely part of the restaurant industry. Many, many times individuals who get into the food truck biz go on to open brick and mortar restaurants. It's an entrepreneurial way for people to get into our business. And so as long as there are fair rules in place for where food trucks go and how they operate compared to the brick and mortar restaurants that they're competing with, we look at it as, you know, as a great way for people to get into the industry. And as I said, to build up their brand and become a brick and mortar restaurant in the future, contributing to the tax base of their communities and everything that, you know, restaurants bring to the table as far as community support.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Sammy is with us now in Green Bay. Sammy, hello.
Hi. So my thoughts on this is, even before the pandemic, I was noticing it where just, you know, you pay $50 for a meal at a restaurant and it's really not that good. Like, you could make that better yourself if you made it at home and for a lot less money. And now that same $50 meal for two people is closer to $80 before you even have to pay for the tip. And it's not any better. It's usually a little bit worse than it was before. So it's hard for me to justify now going to a restaurant unless I know that the quality is there.
Sammy, thanks for the call. Sammy worried about prices going up. And she says, Susan, not seeing the quality there.
Well, it's unfortunate that she's had those experiences. And I know that there's plenty of restaurant operators out there who would love to have the opportunity to showcase their hospitality and their team's cooking talents for you. So I encourage you to continue to try looking for other places. But it, as far as understanding the economics of a restaurant industry, you know, you're right. You can prepare that food at home because you're purchasing in the grocery store. But, you know, food costs, you know, traditionally are only about 1/3 of all of the costs within a restaurant. You also have your labor costs. You have the cost of gas and electricity and all of the fixtures and equipment and pieces of you know, whether it's to-go containers or, you know, flatware or anything else that's in a restaurant. And on top of that, you have the credit card processing fees that go with that, that, you know, all of those factor into the fact, into what that menu price is. And in the end, if you're paying $10 for something, you know, that you have purchased at a restaurant, only 30 to 50 cents of that is going to contribute to any form of bottom line profit for that operation. Everything else is spoken for and all of the other costs. And that is the struggle that restaurant operators have, trying to meet that value proposition that their consumer and their customers are looking for, but also provide all of the other services that it takes to prepare that meal away from home.
Thanks for that call, Sammy. You mentioned those credit card fees, Susan, and I know that's a legislative priority for a lot of the restaurant business groups out there. What's going on? What are you hoping to see change?
Well, you know, credit card processing fees have become the third largest expense for restaurants and many retailers that are out there. But for the fact that it's the third largest expense behind labor and food costs is pretty significant in our industry. And because there's a lack of competition, especially when you dive into all of the intricacies of how those fees are determined, who actually is doing all the routing of the processing and everything else, you know, there's just not a lot of competition there. And what we're doing on a federal level is working real hard to get something called the Credit Card Competition Act passed in at the federal level that would allow restaurant operators and all other merchants out there to be able to have the choice of a couple different options for the back routes and operate that their credit cards are routed through, so that there is some competition, therefore driving down prices and helping bring that relief not only to the merchants that are out there, but to all of the folks that are paying with their credit cards. So we're definitely working on that at the federal level, and here at the state level in the recent budget, we were also able to secure some help for restaurant operators that, you know, have to collect all of the state and local taxes on behalf of government, and increasing the reimbursement that the state gives back for collecting those taxes, since the majority of those taxes are also collected by credit card.
Let's bring on one more caller. Mike is with us in Eau Claire. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've worked in restaurants for most of my life. The last place I worked at, I was there for a good 4-5 years. I gave them everything. And I mean, that owner, you know, I'd be lucky to get a smile and a hello out of them in the morning. Those local restaurant owners, if they could learn how to treat their employees with a little respect, they might not have them, you know, throw their apron on the floor and walk out of there on a Friday night rush like I did. So,
Mike, sorry, it was a rough job. And Susan, you've mentioned you work with restaurant owners to try to help keep people like Mike on the job. What kind of things do you offer restaurant owners when it comes to employee relations?
Well, sure. You know, and I'm sorry that he had that kind of experience. And you know, every industry and every business has, you know, their operators that are people and those who are not. And again, what we're also always encouraging restaurant operators is that they need to be the employer of choice. They need to work with their employees and develop the right culture within their operations so that everybody have, you know, is a valued part of the team. And there's a lot of successful restaurant operations from independent operators up to, you know, some multi-unit franchisees and everyone in between that we know can do a great job of valuing their employees and putting, you know, the best foot forward as far as working with their employees. And we try to help give those solutions on staffing and all those different types of ideas that employees are looking for. And especially as we look and are starting working with the youngest generations of our workforce right now, you know, it's not necessarily pay or the rate of pay that someone's getting is what they're looking for in their employment. And, you know, they're looking for something else relating to how they interact with their job and with their team members. And we're helping operators understand that and implement that in their operations.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. It was my pleasure.
That's Susan Quam with the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. She joined us for a look at recent trends in the restaurant industry. Coming up after the news, we'll look at child labor laws in Wisconsin and around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at the history of women in flight as this year marks the 30th anniversary of women being allowed to fly in combat in the U.S. military. Now, a teenager died last week while working at a meatpacking facility in Mississippi. 16-year-old Duvan Tomas Perez suffered a fatal injury while cleaning a machine at the Marjack poultry plant. And earlier this month, 16-year-old Michael Schulz died from injuries sustained while working at a sawmill here in Wisconsin in Florence County. These are not isolated incidents. A recent report from the Economic Policy Institute identified over 600 active Labor Department investigations into child labor law violations. Those seem to be on the rise. Since 2018, the U.S. Department of Labor has seen a 69% increase in children being employed illegally by companies. Meanwhile, state lawmakers around the country have been proposing legislation aimed at rolling back legal protections for workers under age 18. Workers' rights advocates are sounding the alarm, including our two guests today. They say it's time to strengthen child labor laws and enforcement, not weaken them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed an increase in teen employment, maybe at your workplace or in your community? What concerns do you have about the state of child labor laws and enforcement in Wisconsin, around the country? What questions do you have about what's legal and illegal? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Terry Gerstein is director of the State and Local Enforcement Project at the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy and a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Also with us, Reed Mackey, coordinator of the Child Labor Coalition and director of child labor advocacy at the National Consumers League. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Terry, you just testified to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee this month in written testimony. You wrote that, quote, our country is currently facing a child labor crisis. Now, people might hear a phrase like that and think, well, maybe 100 years ago, but today, a child labor crisis. What is unique about this moment?
Well, what is happening, that I agree, it's very, very surprising. It's something that I think many of us had thought was from the history books and from a century ago. But in fact, as you mentioned earlier, the U.S. Department of Labor has seen a 69% increase in child labor violations in the past 5 years. And state labor departments have also seen an increase. And these include violations of, you know, our child labor laws have two main areas. One, it relates to the hours that children can work so that they don't have to work, you know, such excessive hours or like night shifts in a way that will impede their ability to get an education. And then the other set of laws concerns hazardous occupations, work that is so dangerous, that is like among the most dangerous work that adults can do. It is prohibited for employers to have children do them. And so we're seeing increases in both of these types of violations. And in addition, there's been some media reporting in the New York Times and Reuters and the Boston Globe and elsewhere about some really extreme cases, including teenagers working in sanitation and meatpacking plants or in Hyundai supplier car manufacturing companies. And so these are things that I think for a lot of us just really, in addition to being illegal, you know, shock the conscience and are something that, you know, need to be taken very, very seriously.
And Reid, I know in your organization, you watch for efforts to change laws in states around the country. What do you have your eye on? What are you concerned about as some states anyway look to loosen up some of the regulations on child labor?
These protections were hard won and they took a long time to enact, and we don't like to see them weakened, carelessly by state legislators. And you know, we have in the last, this year alone, we've probably had, eight or nine states that have looked at weakening protections. Last year, we had two states weaken protections. And as Terry said, some of these incidents involve, some of these efforts involve extending the hours that teens can work. And we know that's dangerous and impactful on their education, because academic research suggests that if a teen works more than 20 hours a week during the school week, that their grades start to drop and their school completion starts to plummet. So we definitely want to keep the teen work week under 20 hours. The federal level is 18. Federal protection is 18 hours per work week, and we think that's an adequate protection. So we've also seen states allowing kids to work in hazardous work areas like industrial laundries and meat coolers. And, some of these bills actually had like more ambitiously destructive, regressive ideas of letting kids work in meatpacking loading docks, some really horrible ideas out there.
Terry, apart from the laws on the books, can you talk about enforcement? How much actual enforcement activity is there to make sure that the laws we do have aren't broken?
So I think the U.S. Department of Labor, as well as some state labor departments, are really focused on this and taking it very seriously, but they have been systematically starved of enforcement resources for decades. The Wage and Hour Division is the unit within the U.S. Department of Labor that enforces the child labor laws. It also enforces the minimum wage laws and overtime and prevailing wage and the Family and Medical Leave Act. So it has a whole host of different responsibilities. And to cover the entire country, they only have about 800 investigators. And that's 400 fewer, roughly, than we had in the late 1970s. And when you think of the extent to which the economy has grown, in the decades, it's really, really grossly insufficient to do the job. And state labor departments also are very much understaffed. And so I think that they are taking it very seriously. The U.S. Department of Labor, for example, recently announced a settlement, including in a child labor case, in which they used the hot goods provision, which is this special law that allows them to kind of freeze goods that have been produced with illegal child labor, freeze them so they can't go in the stream of commerce. and they used that tool to get a settlement in a case. So they really are putting a lot of time into this. They filed a big lawsuit against Packer Sanitation, which is the sanitation company that was employing teenagers to clean meatpacking plants in violation of the law. And they did a massive investigation where they visited, you know, half a dozen or more different factories in half a dozen or more different states, and did it in the middle of the night. And, you know, they're really, really taking it seriously, but they simply don't have the resources that are commensurate to the scope of the problem.
Talking about child labor laws and enforcement around the country, Terry Gerstein is with us from the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy, and Reed Mackey with the Child Labor Coalition and Director of Child Labor Advocacy at the National Consumers League. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on this issue, the number is 800-642-1234. Reed, there's an effort to change the law in Wisconsin in 2021. The state legislature passed a law that would extend work hours for some teenagers. You urged Governor Evers to veto that bill, which he ultimately did. One of the arguments at the time, I think, was, hey, we have this labor shortage. We have teenagers who want potentially to work more hours. If their parents are okay with it, why not let it happen? What was your argument against that at the time?
Well, I think I already mentioned it. You know, we know that if kids work more than 20 hours a week during the school week, that there's a good chance that their grades will drop. And they may not finish school, they may not graduate, and that has lifelong repercussions. We don't want to see kids sacrificing their futures, you know, for temporary gain. And I think Governor Evers made the absolutely right choice. If you have to balance a labor shortage on the backs of vulnerable teen workers, there's something wrong.
Terry, can you talk a little bit about the cases, these tragic cases we've seen in Wisconsin and Mississippi, 16-year-olds working in, I think, what are agreed to be fairly hazardous workplaces, a small sawmill, a meatpacking facility in Mississippi. What do those tell us about the state of labor laws, child labor laws in the country?
Well, yes, we have had, in the past, there was a 5-week period in which there were three 16-year-olds killed on the job in three different states. One was in a landfill, one was in a sawmill, and one was in, I think, a poultry processing facility. And again, as I said, there's this list of occupations, of jobs that are the most dangerous occupations for adults, and they are prohibited. It is prohibited for employers to have kids or minors working at these jobs precisely because they're so dangerous. And they weren't just sort of randomly chosen. They were chosen based on data about workplace accidents and injuries and fatality. And so when, you know, people might, you know, I don't know what is the thought process of someone who assigns a 16-year-old or hires a 16-year-old to do these kinds of jobs or to work in these kinds of workplaces. But I think people really need to understand, employers need to understand that this is something that can cause, you know, this is something that is genuinely risky and that can cause death. And if you're the employer, you're going to have to live with that apart from the legal consequences, you're going to have to live with that on your conscience for the rest of your life. But in terms of legal consequences, you know, there have been some criminal prosecutions. I was previously the Labor Bureau Chief in the New York Attorney General's office, and we brought a couple of prosecutions involving kids who were minors, one was killed on the job, a 14-year-old who was killed working on a farm, who'd been working with a skid loader, which is prohibited. And we brought a criminal prosecution as well involving an employer, a teenager whose arm had been severed, and he was working with machinery that was prohibited for a child that age. And I know the Michigan Attorney General just obtained a guilty plea involving a case where there was a minor's hand was amputated. So there is a potential. Many states do have criminal provisions, so there is the potential for very serious consequences for employers when these kinds of events happen.
We're talking today about the state of child labor laws nationally and in Wisconsin. Terry Gerstein is with us from the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy. Reed Mackey from the Child Labor Coalition also with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of protections do you think are most important when it comes to youth participation in the labor force? Did you work as a teenager? Do you think the protections that were out there were what you wanted to see? Do you employ teens? What kind of work are they doing for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Terry Gerstein from the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy and Reed Mackey from the Child Labor Coalition about the state of child labor laws in the country, recent efforts by some state legislatures to roll back child labor protections. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences in the workforce at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Reed, I was reading some of your testimony in some cases. One concern you've raised elsewhere is that these younger workers might be more vulnerable to mistreatment by employers. Can you talk about that concern?
Well, I do think, you know, that younger employers, you know, they have less, like younger employees have less experience and they have a desire to please their employers. It may be their first job. And I don't feel I don't think that they're empowered to express their safety concerns. So if they're asked to do something dangerous, they may go ahead and do it. You know, we saw a teen in Wisconsin trying to unjam a sawmill recently, one of the deaths that Terry mentioned. And, you know, he didn't exercise the proper safety precautions and shut off the conveyor belt, things like that. He probably just didn't even know that he should be doing. So, I think that kids, teenagers particularly, are very vulnerable to getting hurt, especially new employees. A lot of accidents happen in the first, you know, the first day and the first week of employment. So it's just a very precarious situation and kids shouldn't be placed in certain environments.
And Reed, staying with you and the issue of vulnerability, there's particular concern for migrant workers, people in the country legally or without permission, being exploited at workplaces. Is that something you focus on?
Yeah, we're very concerned about that. You know, we know there were 130,000 unaccompanied minors that came into the U.S. last year. These are kids that are have a desperate need for money. They're trying to send it back home to impoverished families in, you know, Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico and other, you know, other countries. And they, you know, they feel like they must work. And I don't think that they know about, you know, the entire infrastructure we have of safety. And you know, they probably enter into like meatpacking plants not knowing how dangerous they are, you know, what conditions they'll find within them. And, you know, we're very concerned about their vulnerabilities and you know, those kids that Terry talked about earlier and then that DOL found in the meatpacking plant, they were kids that, you know, went to school every day after working all night in the graveyard shift, you know, cleaning saws and other kinds of dangerous equipment, using pressure hoses, using chemicals that burned them, you know, just really extreme vulnerability. And then they try to go to school the next day and fall asleep. So we're very, very concerned about that population.
And Terry, you've mentioned accountability for people who violate child labor laws. One reaction I've seen in reading up on some of these is companies say, well, of course, we don't want to employ people illegally, but we work with an employment staffing service. And well, it looks like they got it wrong here. What are your thoughts on that kind of companies distancing themselves from the responsibility here?
Well, that's something that we've seen over and over again, that, for example, some of the major meat corporations, like large multinationals, the biggest meat corporations in the world, were using Packer Sanitation. And then Packer itself was using a staffing agency. And so this whole business model where companies subcontract and then they use a staffing company or an employment company, employment agency, it's a way for the lead corporations at the top of a supply chain, the name brands that really do have the ability to impact violations and to prevent them. It's a way for them to distance themselves from responsibility because they've insulated themselves by putting this other layer. What is so interesting that happened in the case involving Packer, the sanitation company, is that JBS, a major meat company corporation, they, after this all came to light, they actually created JBS Sanitation, and they're taking a number of these jobs in-house and not subcontracting anymore. And they have an agreement with UFCW, a union, to make them union jobs. And so, you know, there's no law of nature that corporations, say a meatpacking plant, has to subcontract for their sanitation. They can hire their own employees to do this and thereby ensure that the child labor laws are not violated, or they can exercise a lot of control over their subcontractors and really monitor them and make it clear if you have child labor violations, you are out immediately. And they don't do these things. And if we had laws, we do have laws that allow for what's called joint employer liabilities. You can try and go up the chain, but it can be challenged. As a lawyer, I can say it can be challenging to do that sometimes. You really have to have a very strong set of facts. While if we had ways to create really clear, easy, ready accountability up the supply chain, certainly for cases where there are repeat violations or widespread violations, in other words, when that lead corporation can't really say, I had no idea because it's so widespread or it's happened over and over, I think that's something that would really, that liability for them would really incentivize them to clean up their house.
Let's bring on a caller. Rachel is with us in Milwaukee. Rachel, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment that I feel like the child labor laws are really not enforced, particularly in slaughterhouses where they might have children that are from other countries working there. And I know in the case where the boy that just died in Mississippi in the chicken slaughterhouse, he was from Guatemala, and that that particular slaughterhouse had a history of very dangerous working conditions and also recent deaths there. So it's shameful that, you know, that this happened. It should have never happened, and there needs to be more oversight, more enforcement, and more strict punishment, not just a fine, and they keep doing the same thing.
Rachel, thanks for the call. Reed, Rachel worried that we're overlooking this major industry with major problems when it comes to child labor. Is this a part of the economy that needs more focus?
We've been worried about meatpacking since 2008 when there was an immigration raid in Iowa that found 50 kids working illegally in a kosher meatpacking plant. I think we're going to see more revelations about kids working in these settings. And, I think that Terry's also right that we need to hold the ultimate employer more accountable. And that's something that DOL said that they would do in the future when they announced their meatpacking findings, but they didn't do it in the case of the investigation that concluded this year. So we really need to hold them to that position and make sure that that corporate entities are held more accountable.
Thanks a lot for that call. Terry, in our last minute or so, what do you have your eye on most closely as states around the country are looking to change labor laws, in some cases loosen them up for child labor? What has you most worried right now?
I mean, what has me most worried is laws that would allow younger children to work in dangerous jobs. For example, in Iowa, Iowa passed a law that allows the state to exempt certain employers and allow them, if they get permission from the state, to have kids working in more dangerous workplaces. Now, the federal law still, trumps the Iowa law in that case, and employers still have to follow the federal law, but I think it could be very confusing for employers. And I think what really needs to be done is strengthening child labor laws, putting more money into enforcement, having stronger penalties, both civil and criminal, as well as holding lead corporations responsible. And also potentially allowing child labor victims and whistleblowers to file their own lawsuits so that all of the enforcement, it doesn't have to come just from the government, but so that there is a way for workers themselves to file lawsuits. But I do think we need to strengthen the laws to make sure that kids are safe and able to get an education rather than weakening them.
We'll leave it there. Terry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Reed, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Been talking to Terry Gerstein, director of the State and Local Enforcement Project at the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy and senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute, and Reed Mackey, coordinator of the Child Labor Coalition, director of the Child Labor Advocacy at the National Consumers League. We talked about the recent deaths of two teenagers working dangerous jobs and what their stories tell us about child labor laws and enforcement. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, wildfire smoke has brought a lot of attention to air quality in Wisconsin. Find out how we monitor for unsafe ozone levels and what it means when we find it. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. With the hot weather this week, your thoughts might be turning to ice cream. Mine did. We got some at home. But what is your favorite flavor? And what's Wisconsin's favorite flavor? The online shopping company Instacart compared flavor preferences by state. Now, you might guess vanilla would be the most popular flavor nationwide, and it is. But in this analysis, they look for flavors that are uniquely popular in each state where people liked it a lot more than the national average. On that scale, vanilla still topped the list in 21 states. But here in Wisconsin, the standout flavor is Moose Tracks. The original definition of Moose Tracks, vanilla ice cream with peanut butter cups and Moose Tracks fudge. One company owns the basic Moose Tracks name and concept, but they license it to different companies. So that's why you see different brands of Moose Tracks in the store. It's big in the Midwest. Wisconsin, Iowa, and Michigan are the only three states with Moose Tracks as the standout flavor. I can't vouch for the scientific validity of this report, but I plan to continue my own personal research into this important topic. This is Central Time.